in 2022, we did our impact report and we found that our average users saved about 20% on their carbon footprint, which is similar to what we saw in 2021, and also saved about $200 a year while they were doing it. And so we'd like to really expand on that this year.
One of the most popular episodes of Who's Saving the Planet is called How to Turn Your Credit Card into a Force for Good. In that episode, I spoke with Sanchali Powell, the CEO of a company named Juro that was helping consumers better understand their carbon footprint by tying directly into their credit card spending habits. Well, Juro is now called Commons, and Sanchali is back with 10 million reasons to be more optimistic about the future of our planet. My name is Lex Kiefaber. Welcome to Who's Saving the Planet. Commons, which you can find at thecommons.earth, is an app that ties directly into your credit card to help map out your carbon footprint and also provide access to products that are going to help reduce it. When we last spoke to Sanchali, they were just at that phase where they were trying to reach that tipping point, to get to that place where they had product market fit, to demonstrate that there was a real appetite for this type of product and the consumers were adopting it and they were ready to grow. Well, since then, Sanchali has raised $10 million from Sequoia Capital, the founders of Afterpay, and none other than Jay-Z, along with a host of other investors. And so what I was really curious about was what allowed for that unlock, for that huge step function growth of support from these investors to go from saying, well, this is a product that we think has legs, to something that says, this is really going to have a big impact. Let's throw a bunch of money behind it because we think this is going to be huge. What changed? Here's what Sanchali said.
Yeah, I mean, this has been a kind of wild year to be running a company of any kind. Going out to raise towards the end of last year, it was a pretty uncertain time in the market. But I think what was helpful for us is that we had focused on our unit economics first. We were building a pretty different kind of business. We're building an app that helps people manage the carbon emissions of their lifestyle and make sustainable spending choices. There's not really an incumbent in that space. There's no existing player that we're going up against. We're trying to create a new category. And as we were doing that, especially in the climate space, we knew one of the first things we had to prove was that people were willing to pay for this, that there was a business model here. And our initial revenue model is based on offsets. So users who would like to offset the emissions they now can track in the app can do so automatically, and we curate a portfolio of high-quality offsets for them. So going into this raise, I think what we were seeing that was most interesting and exciting was that folks who we were having pretty good rates of subscription, folks who subscribed had were paying a significant amount. I mean, compared to most mobile apps, don't make any money for a while. But in our app, people were paying an average of something like $30 a month to offset their carbon footprint. And when they did, they were sticking around for a really long time. So we had great retention numbers. And I think that was really, it's probably quite unusual for an app going out to raise a Series A. Most apps going out to raise a Series A would raise on growth numbers. And that was not our strength. Our strength was unit economics. But I think in the current market environment, that was helpful to show that there is a business model here once we can scale it. And really, that's what the next chapter of Now Commons is about, is figuring out that path to meaningful scale.
We're going to talk about the Now Commons part that you slid in there. Don't worry, I'm not sliding past that. But I think that first thing is an important point, which is that there was this sea change that happened in 2021 leading into 2022, where the sugar rush that was free money, zero interest rates for large scale companies to be able to borrow money and then redeploy that back into the system, led to these crazy growth numbers in terms of investment size and round size based on a combination of like good vibes and sexy user metrics without any really focus on like, does this thing make money? Is this thing a business? And you're seeing that fall out. You're seeing that sort of this, that to paraphrase the famous Warren Buffett phrase, when the tide goes out, you see who isn't wearing any pants. And there are so many companies now that are like, we raised all this money. We're never going to be able to actually grow at the rate that we're needing to go raise the next round of money. And so there's this hangover effect happening where you've got these well-capitalized companies that are just in this weird state of purgatory or limbo. And you guys went a different route. You're like, let's figure out an actual business model that's going to work. I feel like that is commendable. And if anything, that was forward thinking.
I mean, I think that it was lucky that that was the approach we ended up taking. And I think, to be honest, we were still quite early. Obviously, Series B and C companies were affected much more than a Series Seed going out for their A. But it doesn't stop us from having to figure out the growth question. It's still a really important part of making sure we can build a business that can make a huge impact and also be really successful from a financial perspective. It just happens to be that we put those in a different order than most companies did at that time.
From a personal CEO, like, you've been working on this 5 years into this now. What did it feel like when you got that kind of validation to really, like, you know, $10 million, that's a real number. What did that feel like for you?
I mean, in some ways it was a huge relief and something I never knew if I was going to get to, because, you know, so many companies fail before they get to their Series A. And I knew the numbers beforehand. I knew that 70% of startups fail before their Series A. And it was even after being well capitalized in their seed. And so I think that was something that I was never, you never know what's going to happen until it does. And it did feel really good, especially because until that point, you know, we'd been quite scrappy. We'd done quite a lot with not that much money. And to know that we now had the resources to take a pretty big swing at this problem we really want to solve was really amazing. At the same time, I feel like the market was kind of crumbling, and we have now this very daunting task in front of us, which is, like, scale a climate app to the mainstream. So it's also, I feel like, no rest for the weary when it comes to startups. You know, there's always the next thing that you're worried about. So it wasn't that long, but I definitely took a weekend and felt really good about it.
Who was the first person you told?
Oh, definitely my husband, because poor guy is, like, always in the other room when I'm doing my pitches, and I need the good desk so that I can do my pitches. But no, definitely he's been with me since the beginning, and he's also in the climate space. He knows how hard it is, and it's always been the person who supports me.
So now you're at this place where you have money in the bank and a mandate to say, now we need to achieve that next milestone, such as the world of venture-backed companies. You are never done until that IPO hits market. So in the course of that, you made what I'm sure was a very existential and personal decision to say, we are going to change the thing, what the name of this company is. And so it was Jura when we first had you on, and now it is Commons. Why, first of all, did you try to do that? And then second, was there a sense of that, like was it a sense like you were growing up, like you were going out of that adolescence phase, or were you leaving something behind? Because, like, I know the idea of a name for a company is a very personal thing, and you become so attached to it. So let's talk with the first, like, the impetus. Why did you decide to do it? And then how did you feel about it when you did it?
I had been thinking about it for a while. So before we did the official switch over in March of this year, we probably made the decision in summer of last year. And the main reason why was that we realized the word didn't mean anything to anyone. It's a four-letter word. If you know what it means, it was the Nordic mythology protector of the earth. So the goddess of the earth in Norse mythology. But most people don't know that. Most people have heard of Thor, not his mother, Joro. And it was the kind of thing that wasn't giving us any help in customer recognition. Mm-hmm. It was already a novel concept. The word Joro didn't mean anything to anyone. People couldn't remember what it was. They had no idea what it was, even once they heard the name. And I think especially when you're creating a new category and a new behavior, the name can do a lot of work for you in helping people understand what it is the product does. So we wanted to pick a name that did more work for us. Also recognizing that we currently have hopefully fewer users than we'll ever have in the future. The next phase is about scale. If we're going to make this change, we have to do it now. And then we also did some market testing on the word Joro, and we found that some of the associations with it were, like, really strange. For instance, Joe Rogan. I had no idea that was one of the associations people had with the word Joe Rogan.
It's kind of a shocking thing to be like, to not realize that you've stumbled into.
Yeah, I was like, oh, interesting. That's not what I expected. But regardless, it didn't inspire trust and it didn't help people understand what the product did. We wanted a word that better communicated the idea that you are taking action with other people, and that's where the power of your action comes from. So that's where sort of commons came in as a word that helps people. Once you hear it and you know what the product does, you understand. And also it really emphasizes more of the collective or the community aspect of this product.
When you said, people associate things with that, with Joe Rowe and Joe Rogan, frankly, I reference the idea of tragedy of the commons so often when I'm talking to people about this issue of climate change, because it's such an obvious corollary. I may be a total one of that. So tragedy of commons is this idea that if we don't take personal responsibility for something that we all share, then people end up trying to extract as much as they can from it. And so when it was first developed, I think in like the pasture sheep farming in England in the 17th, 18th century, people would overgraze their sheep in such a way that then the land became fallow for everyone, and thus the tragedy of the commons. And like I often, climate change is an obvious corollary there. That could be completely just me inside my world. But was that something that you were also playing off of when you were thinking about this?
Definitely. It was something, it was a part of the reason we love that word. I studied economics. My interest in this space came from economics. And I think that the concept of tragedy of the commons is fascinating because it's also been debunked as in terms of being inescapable. It's definitely not inescapable. It does happen. The phenomenon of the tragedy of the commons does happen. But the first woman to win the Nobel Prize in Economics, Eleanor Ostrom, through her work showed that there are many community-driven solutions in which the commons are responsibly stewarded. Mm-hmm. And it is not inevitable to have a tragedy of the commons without government intervention, that people and communities can self-regulate to responsibly use their resources in a way that's equitable and abundant for those communities. And that's like, I thought that was so super powerful.
We're not doing great as a planet in terms of solving this issue. And that continues to be the case. We continue to miss the targets that we set out. And so we continue to see weather events that are increasingly catastrophic and frequent, and we continue to see heat rising. So when we're thinking about the way that the commons can play with this, one of the things that I liked about it so much was that it can kind of sit on top of everything from a personal level, where it can be somewhat frictionless in the sense that the app itself works in the background. You don't need to participate with it in order to benefit from it. But also it is pervasive to everywhere that you spend money, which of course is the engine that is driving this capitalistic machine that is causing so many of the problems in which we're in. Which brings me to that point in that question. How are you guys doing and how are you guys thinking about addressing this problem in a systemic way, and what has changed since we last spoke that is putting you in a stronger position to help build that better future?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the reality of the last year hasn't just been hard for startups. It's been hard for a lot of people around the world, especially here in the US. The economic environment has been challenging, and people are thinking more than ever about how they spend their money and where they spend their money. People want to save money. They want to make sure that the things that they're buying are going to last. And more folks, especially the younger generations who are becoming bigger and bigger parts of our consumer markets, are prioritizing sustainability in a way that we haven't seen happening before. It's still early days. I think that the number of people who say that they want to buy sustainable products is still much higher than the number of folks who are buying sustainable products. But it's not only because of cost. It's also because it's hard to navigate and to understand what to buy, as you know well. And I think that's something, as consumers are becoming more and more discerning about where they spend their money, which companies deserve their money, we can help them make those choices in a way that's better for them and better for the earth. Mm-hmm. something we've been thinking about a lot is sort of going beyond carbon footprinting. And a lot of, I think the folks who want to track their carbon footprint, want to offset their carbon footprint, many of them have found us. If they're using our product, most of them are pretty happy with it. They're sticking around. They're using it over time. But then there's a lot of people out there who want to live more sustainably and don't know what a carbon footprint is, don't necessarily need to know what a carbon footprint is, just want to make better spending choices in their daily lives. And that's where we've been spending more of our effort, is to be able to deliver practical, useful guidance that helps people spend better and save money and save carbon. Well, actually, last year in 2022, we did our impact report and we found that our average users saved about 20% on their carbon footprint, which is similar to what we saw in 2021, and also saved about $200 a year while they were doing it. And so we'd like to really expand on that this year.
You get if you're pushing on the financial aspect, I feel like that's something that's so much more tangible to most people than the existential but harder to understand benefit of not dying as a species. One of my old CEOs said that the world could be described in, you know, three graphs, and you could pick whatever one of those three graphs were and most things would apply to them. And one of those three graphs was a normal distribution graph, which sort of looks like a giant hill. And the idea being that most things fall on this normal distribution where you have the median or the average in the middle, and then that extends on either side, sort of a less and less frequent instance of things. And when you were describing what you were thinking about your consumers and how what they react to, I feel like that sort of normal distribution, the biggest part of that pie are the people that are like, I don't really want to have to do anything. I don't really want to have to think about very much. I do want to be directionally good. And I'm willing to spend like a small amount of money to get there, but I just want the credit for doing it. And it sounds like you're really, you know, whereas the people that are going to be incredibly discerning and probably already shopping very sustainably are actually going to be very bad customers for you guys because they're making their own choices and trying to do it in a way that makes them a much harder person to convert because they have a lot of knowledge that they're bringing to the table already, which is good as a people, but like not great in terms of finding the right kind of place to target your marketing engine. Are you guys finding that in terms of like, where is the biggest slice of this pie that you can capture both as a business and as the opportunity to affect change?
Yeah, I think to your point, we'd like to target that slice of folks who want to do more but are finding it too difficult right now and kind of have given up or feel kind of powerless or just like it's not worth trying, because those are the folks who we can help the most and those are the folks who can have the greatest impact. And there are also more of them than the ones who are really high intentioned and really highly educated. And to your point, with sort of the very challenging climate goals that we're facing and the lack of progress we've made so far, those are the folks we need to convince sooner to do more to get there.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's the sheer volume of them and the amount of money that they spend is much more than the people on the, if you imagine like, you know, that bell curve on the far right, you have people that are off the grid and living an entirely sort of like self-contained hermetic lifestyle that is just using no resources. And then people who are completely apathetic or even in favor of the idea of a worse future. And like neither one of those are going to be good customers. As you get closer to the middle, the opportunity to find those people is going to be more. But your biggest, the challenge now is, how do you find them and how do you get them to download this app? And like, I feel like that's sort of that's the world that you're living in now, where there's a rebrand happening, you've got money in the bank and you're going to go capture this audience. So walk me through it. What's the game plan? How is Commons going to be something that is ubiquitous and indispensable in the next 5 years?
Ooh, I wish I knew the answer to that, but I will tell you what we think it's going to be and what we're trying out and we'll see. Really, what we've been leaning into more is content. We've found that the majority of the users who found us so far have found out about us either through word of mouth or through some form of content, whether it's a blog, a podcast like this, an article that's been written about us. So we've been thinking about how can we clearly, like, there's some interest in the information that we're putting out, and how can we make that easier to access and higher in volume? So we've been working more on our Instagram presence. We just started on TikTok. Let's see how that goes. And also been working on our blog. There's so much research that we've done for the work in the app that we want to be able to surface that information to folks even outside the app. And so our website is starting to become a more important part of how we share that information. I think a lot of it too is that we're still working on how do we build. We have a smallish group of users who on the app love the product and are coming back. And then how do we expand that group of users to create that more viral growth engine? And that's where some of the new features we've been working on around sustainable spending and sustainable brands can hopefully provide value to a larger group of users faster.
Well, let's talk about that then, because I think that's a really interesting feature set that you guys are deploying. What it used to be, we talked about this on the last podcast as well, that when you were to buy something, it was bucketed by category. So if I bought shoes, it was sort of, here's what we think shoes are. And there was no deeper nuance into it. And you have since evolved that method to create more specificity around the products that you're buying within specific categories. So how did you go about doing that? And how does it feel different to the user today than it did a year ago?
Yeah, so this is relatively new. We just launched it in August, which is basically 2 points. So before, maybe you spent $100 at Allbirds, we would say, great job, you spent $100 on shoes, and that has a carbon footprint of 20 kgs of CO2. You might have also spent $20 at Foot Locker, and we would say you also have 20 kgs of CO2. That was directionally correct of like the approximate magnitude of that purchase. And it's helpful if you're trying to think about what's the carbon footprint of my shoes versus my food versus my gasoline. That's where it's really valuable.
Right.
But what it doesn't do is say like, okay, you needed to buy shoes. Was it more or less sustainable to buy them from Allbirds or Foot Locker? And how did your carbon footprint change based on the sustainability of the company that you bought from? Because companies are obviously a really important lever for change. And when we're spending money, we're kind of voting for the companies that we want to exist in the world. So now what we're doing is we're showing Allbirds is actually a climate neutral brand. They've tracked, reduced, and offset the emissions of their full supply chain. And they've taken responsibility for those emissions. So they're actually not passing those emissions on to you as the consumer anymore. So now you as a consumer, when you shop at Allbirds, you get zero carbon footprint because that's not part of your footprint. It's part of Allbirds' footprint now. Or if you bought clothing secondhand, you don't have the same carbon footprint as someone who bought clothing new. We actually count that as zero carbon footprint right now in the app as well, because you didn't incur any new emissions for that clothing purchase than someone else already had. They already took on those emissions for you. So I think those are really powerful ways that we can show people the carbon footprint of your spending doesn't just have to be about your behavior change. It can actually also be about the switches you make from less sustainable companies to more sustainable companies. And I think that could be really powerful for folks as you're thinking about there's things in your life that you just have to buy. There's basically, unless you're going to make everything yourself, I think you're never going to avoid spending money. And if you can use that money to support companies who are actually taking meaningful steps to lower their emissions, that's when we can really influence a larger proportion of our companies and our nation's climate goals.
This is a world that I've spent so much time digging into, and it's so hard from a consumer's perspective as well, but even from the perspective of somebody who knows comparatively a lot and thinks a lot about sustainability, it's so hard to find both good, accurate information and also relevant information. Because this idea of sustainability, carbon is one aspect and perhaps the chief aspect, but it can mean so many things. For instance, you brought up resale. That is another aspect of sustainability. Also durability, right? Let's say I go buy a pair of shoes. One's going to last me 10 years. The others are going to be inoperable. They're going to fall apart in 6 months. If I buy something that's going to last 10 years and I repair it, even if it costs three times as much carbon when I buy it, that's going to last a long time. Or things around social justice, or making sure that things are created fairly and properly, and that people are treated fairly along the way, and that companies are being good stewards of the land, and that all of these things roll into it. And there's two parts about that. One is understanding it and just being able to quantify it in some way. And the second part, which I find to be so bedeviling, but so important, is communicating that.
finding a way to take that information and deliver it to somebody that's going to actually affect the way that they think about their choice.
Yeah.
How have you guys started to crack that nut?
I mean, to your point, it is so difficult. Information is not standardized. And it's not reliable because a lot of it's self-reported too. So it's incredibly hard. I think that what we're trying to do is take a carbon-first approach, but not a carbon-only approach. So we are focusing on emissions. That is what we do best, is helping people understand the carbon impact of their choices and lower them as they're working on it. But I think that the other pieces that you talked about are really important as well. We don't want to live in a world that's low carbon, but it's falling apart from an ecological perspective, or that doesn't support labor rights and perpetuates income inequality. Like, there's so many things that could go wrong. And we want to be able to help people make choices that are, they can feel confident are just better than the choices they were making before. So the way we've gotten started with that is by focusing on companies that have inherently sustainable business models. So that means thrifting, renewable energy, farmers markets, things that are measurably just that business model is lower carbon than another kind of business model. And we want to support those business models that are shifting us towards the green transition, bike share, you know, electric cars, all of those things. And then secondarily, companies that have really taken responsibility for the emissions of their supply chains. That is where the data gets harder. To start with, we've partnered with the Climate Neutral Certification to onboard all of the brands who have, in a standardized way with a third party, actually measured, reduced, and offset the emissions of their supply chain.
Shout out to Austin over there. Carbon is Austin. He's always like the most, every time I talk to him, I'm like, you need to be more emotional. And he's like, buddy, I'm doing a hard thing. And I'm like, okay, fair enough, Austin. But anyway, yes, great organization. We're big fans. Yeah. I'll send him a copy of this and saying he got a shout out just to perk him up a little bit over there, Austin. We love you, buddy.
Austin and the Climate Neutral team have been great. We're actually going through the Climate Neutral certification process ourselves, so that's exciting. And I think it's a really great way. We need more standardized third-party verification, especially ones that are nonprofits and don't have their own, you know, separate interests in this. So we're going to be working on expanding that data set as well, trying to keep it as rigorous as we can while also being practical that, you know, there's no such thing as perfection. All companies are on a path towards progress, just like we are.
Yeah. Don't let enemy be the better of good. Don't let perfect be the enemy of good. The oft misattributed Voltaire quote, and I totally don't remember who actually said it. So I will continue to misattribute that. All right. So what do you then, before we get to the last question, for the people listening to this, let's do a shout out for how they can find you and what they should do when they find you.
Yeah. So you can check us out in the App Store or the Play Store. Look for Commons and you'll find our app. Download it. It's free. You can see your carbon footprint for free. You can browse sustainable brands for free. If you want to offset, that's when you pay money. But it's really important to us that access to information is available to anyone. You can also follow us on Instagram at the.commons.earth or find us online at thecommons.earth.
Okay. All of that will be in the show notes as well. Last question then. It's two-part last question. The first last question, which is also one that I asked you before, and I'm curious if you remember what you said, but I asked people, if you were to go back and give yourself advice at the beginning of this, what advice would you give yourself?
I feel like what I probably said and what I still believe is just keep going. Like, perseverance is half the battle.
Interesting.
Is that what I said?
Sort of. So I went back and I listened to it this morning in anticipation of this. Sort of. What you said was that when you got into climate, you felt it was incredibly daunting, and doing it as a solo entrepreneur was something that you also felt like was incredibly daunting. And you wished that you had understood sooner that you could do this, and that even the people that are purporting to be the climate experts of the world actually don't know enough to make it impossible for somebody else to jump into the space. And it's interesting that now your answer is like, just keep going, because it's that's such a transition from that first step of like, jump in
And then it's like, don't sink.
Yeah, that's true. It's like, get started. You can do it. Literally, no one is smarter than you. Like, all humans have very high levels of intelligence. Everyone can do this. You don't need a PhD. And that's true. I think that was a big part of it, is getting over that hump that you can do something really amazing that no one else can do. And then also keep trying, because you're never going to, like, no one knows everything. Even the most successful entrepreneurs have gone through periods of really difficult times. And I feel like I heard a quote by Seth Rogen the other day, where he was talking about how, like, don't quit, because then, I mean, it's like a thing a lot of people say, but he just said it and it stuck in my head for some reason, that of course, if you quit, you're going to fail. But if you don't quit, you might succeed. And I feel like that's the phase I'm in right now, is just keep trying. It's possible it might still not work, but at least we tried.
So then the next question that I will ask is, between this time and the last time we spoke, you achieved this huge milestone from the business perspective, and you were able to do that because you focused on something that other people weren't. You were looking at the user economics and saying, like, the unit economics of your users, and saying, like, does this thing make sense as a business? And where most people are looking for the sugar rush of growth and sort of burning through capital, you guys were good stewards of the money that you had, and that was rewarded with more money from more people and more chances to stay alive. There's going to be a future version of you that we're going to talk to that's like past your Series B, right? And so now you've raised $30 million or $50 million or whatever it is. What will that version of you, do you think, say, this was the thing that that we focused on that allowed us to get to this point?
I think that the one thing that I feel like we really need to do if we're going to have a chance of succeeding is be really sharp about testing one hypothesis at a time. It is so easy to get distracted and or to work on too many things at once. And I think this has been a real challenge for me personally, because we are dealing with so many uncertainties in this business that it's very appealing to try to work on many things at once. But the reality is, if you can have one strong hypothesis and have the whole team working on proving or disproving that hypothesis as quickly as possible, then you can move to the next hypothesis. And I think that is something that we are trying to build as a team, is how do we align quickly, test and learn, so that we can disprove the things that aren't working as fast as possible. So I think that figuring out what that motion looks like for us at the stage we're at and the size of the team we're at, I think if we can crack that, I feel like we've already been learning a lot faster than we were before. And if we can keep accelerating that pace of learning in the next few months, I think we have a good chance of figuring this out.
I cannot wait to talk to future you, and we can then come back and revisit this and see how things netted out. It'll be fascinating to learn what past you and future you agree on.
Me too. I can't wait to meet them. And you and I will meet her together. It'll be fun.
Thank you so much for coming back on board. And again, congratulations, Sandra. Not very many people make it as far as you have already. And you should be proud of that. And it is because of your perseverance and your hard work and your shrewdness. So congratulations.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And I'm excited to come back and see where it's gone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Who's Saving the Planet. You can find more about Commons at thecommons.earth. We'll see you next week for another story of somebody who's working to build a more sustainable future.